Well, hello, and a very warm welcome back to the Andrew Eborn Show. And one of my favourite parts is a pair of briefs. And to help me with that, I'm delighted to be joined yet again by Stephen Barrett. How are you, Stephen?
I'm good. I'm good. This is, oh, well, I've got Cliff Richard's Mistletoe and Wine stuck in my head.
Hey,
Other than that, I'm fine.
Hey, glorious! We love old Cliff. He's a good mate of another mate of mine, the DJ Mike Reed. Do you remember Mike?
I do remember Mike Reed. God, it's going back a bit since the last time I heard his him speaking. But yeah, no, these people were seminal parts of childhood.
Well, yeah, absolutely. He's been broadcasting throughout, even in lockdown. We did a show together. We called it ER, the Eborn and Reed Show, a journey to the ER, and lots of fun. I mean, it's one of the things that you can do, the joy of Zoom. We're all Zoomed working on that sort of basis. So no, he's around, but no, he was great friends with Mistletoe and Wine and that sort of stuff. And extraordinary what's going on. Everybody's rushing to get to the Christmas number one. That's what I miss. I'll tell you what, growing up, it's always about that. It was all about the countdown and Top of the Pops and who was going to be Christmas number one. There was a big buzz about it, wasn't there?
There was, and there was a buzz about number one every week, and we've lost a lot of this. So somebody was explaining why we are as we are now is that the youth subculture no longer cares about music in the way that you traditionally, generationally, people would care about music. So for me, it was Oasis and Blur, and that was a big thing, and you know, everybody cared about it, and you will have had whatever your generation was, and that's what we all did, and we all obsessed about that, and there were mods and rockers and all the rest of it. But now everybody's getting their identity in a different way at that age. Their rebellion is much more focused on things like being non-binary or having purple hair or being, you know, a campaigner for just stop anything fun, you know. And
or maybe all three. I know, getting all three if you get your bingo card. It's kind of...
But they do that but the sad fact is that they do all that instead of music. And when it was music, at least we got some really good tunes.
I was seeing a friend down to St Pancras yesterday, and they had the wonderful artist called Tom Grennan, who was there, who did a spontaneous performance on those little pianos. You know, Elton John donated a piano, and there's a few more have sprung up. And he did this performance of It Can't Be Christmas. So he did that fantastic stuff. It was sorted out, and there was a big crowd around there. So I filmed it on my phone, and the Daily Mail got in touch and said, oh, can we use it? And I said, well, I don't obviously have any rights to the underlying composition, but as the creator of the film, to the extent of any rights I've got, they've got. So there it is. It's on their site. So you go and have a look at the Andrew Eborn Show, Octopus TV. I made sure we got a credit. And they even threw me a few quid by an extra round at Christmas. So all good stuff. But I miss it. It's going to be good. But talking about what's really interesting, I've been looking at your revelations, if you like, with your new Substack, and you're getting lots of people responding, and they're responding very well to A Pair of Briefs as well, and sending in questions. And one of the things that you've been looking at is international law. And we always bandy these terms around. And what I love, Stephen, is that we use these programs for unpacking, getting through the jargon and the questions that people are often too scared to ask in case they look silly. Well, there's no such thing as a silly question. There are only silly answers. And I think the reality is what we're doing on this wonderful series is unpacking all of those, taking things back to basic and then sort of building accordingly. So one of the things that you've been talking about is international law. So what is international law?
Well, I will answer that, but I just want to point out, I want to pick up that there are no silly questions thing, because there really aren't. And lawyers have to hold this line above all else. So during the financial crisis was caused by a thing called derivatives. And the banks were going around and selling each other derivatives. And it wasn't until after the financial crisis, after this terrible scandal, eventually, obviously, things get to court cases. And the first High Court judge just said, right, gentlemen, what is a derivative? And that because the judge asked that question, which is, a lot of people probably think that's a stupid question. But what then happened is that we've discovered that nobody actually had one definition of what a derivative was. And none of the regulators had a definition of what a derivative was. So this is just sort of cascading throughout the system. And it wasn't a stupid question at all. It was an absolutely brilliant question. It was just that all the bankers had felt really thick if they'd asked, what is a derivative? And they just all pretended to know.
Yeah, it's so true in everything, and as you know, we both advise people from all sorts of industries, and I really think a lot of people just hide behind this jargon. They sort of think, "Well, we're a professional. Don't dare question us." And obviously, what we want to do is question everything. We have to become in cross-examination when looking at expert witnesses, if you like. We have to understand, cut through the jargon, understand what the basic issues are. And actually, people are much cleverer than you give that most people give them credit for. And if you get rid of the jargon, actually, most things make common sense, don't they?
Yes, and if they can't be understood, then they're probably pretty stupid. That's the other thing to point out. There's nothing irritates me more than academics on Twitter who write in impenetrable language. It's like, I don't think you're clever. I think you're thick. That's what I think. If you can't explain it to me, I'm not going to sit there and think, oh dear, my brain's fallen out of my ear. I'm going to sit there thinking you're a moron who's just using fancy words to sound clever.
Yeah,
But.
it's totally that. And you and I, we appear on more platforms than Paddington, going to TV studios, doing exactly that, just unpacking the legal cases. And people get all sorts of jargon. And the problem with sort of TV shows and the media is you get like a 2 minute spot or something to explain a really complicated case, which might have gone on for sometimes months, actually. And it's understanding the real issues and that sort of stuff. But as I say, we've got the joy of time on our hands. It's never sort of turning around and saying, well, I've got to leave it there, Stephen, unfortunately. We will never leave it there. The questions will continue to be answered. And as I say, for each of these, we're going to unpack. And if anybody is interested, you have a question that you'd like to us to look at here on A Pair of Briefs, do get in touch at Andrew Eborn, at Octopus TV, and I'll share it with Stephen accordingly. It will appear on his Substack as well as elsewhere. But let's talk about then international law. And let's start. What is international law and why is it relevant?
So it's always been relevant, which is what's interesting about international law, because it's got, in our age, it's got this sort of self-identity that it's modern and new and bright and shiny. But the oldest example we've got is the treaty after the Battle of Kadesh, which was in 1300 BC. So it's old, okay? And it's the idea, it's a very logical idea. Once you get humans bandying together in villages and in groups, they will stumble across the idea that there should be rules. You get this even with nomadic hunter-gatherers. Men will go do the hunting, women will stay and do the gathering. Those are rules, those are laws. And you get this idea that we're regulated by rules and laws, and that's, I think, a ubiquitous human thing. But then once you start bumping into foreigners, you get into the idea that, ooh, maybe there should be some rules and laws that bind us. And it began, as I say, you should always focus on treaties. I think anybody who talks about international law and doesn't begin by talking about treaties is probably a shyster, because there's all sorts of, at the moment, we'll get onto this later, but the communists are trying to use international law for their own advancement. So we've got to sort of treat it a bit iffy for a moment. But we've also got to accept that the idea of getting rid of it is not going to work. Okay, so there's no anybody who thinks that you can just say, oh, international law is not law, and that get out. No, that's not an answer to the problem. We've needed it for 3,000 years, probably longer. We'll carry on needing it. What we should do is focus on the idea of it being treaties. Once you get to the idea of it being treaties firmly lodged in your head, you start to understand that really it's just a contract. Okay, and people listening will be forming contracts in their daily lives. Almost everything, contract law is one of the most common types of law we have. When I teach young people, I usually talk about contract law because it's just so accessible. Every time you go into M&S, you enter into a contract with M&S. They put it on the shelf, they offer it at a price, you pick it up from the shelf and accept that offer. You go to the till and you pay the money over, and all of these are contractual terms, things that you're supposed to do under your contract. We're all familiar with things like our gas and electricity contracts. One of the things that deeply irritates me is Domino's Pizza, because they call their contract boring legal stuff. And that, firstly, that just, I just think that's inflammatory and unnecessary. But secondly, that's just nonsense, because contracts are interesting. And also, I think, by the way, Domino's are particularly stupid for doing that, because you could argue that therefore they're incentivizing you not to read the contract, and therefore you can't be bound by the terms, because they didn't even want you to read it because they called it boring legal stuff. So they might be hoisted by their own petard there. But Domino's is probably protected on the basis that nobody's going to sue over pizza because
Well, they might
it's
do, and I think we should have the very first person they can come on as a guest for anybody who takes your advice and challenges Domino's on these sort of bases. Tell me how that might work in practice before you move on. What sort of contract then, as far as Domino's are concerned?
So we once we started to get we used to have you used to just negotiate the terms of your contract. So you'd be in the village, you'd talk to the village blacksmith, and you'd negotiate terms with the village blacksmith, and the law would enforce those terms. Then you start to get really big companies, and really big companies start going, I don't want to negotiate terms with everybody, I want to have standard terms and conditions. And the law sort of goes, okay. And then we have massive problems, and they're really abusive because unregulated power, humans always go corrupt. So, we start to get abusive terms. So, in the 70s, we sort of stumbled across this idea of, well, let's regulate contractual terms that are deemed unfair. And so, we get this Unfair Contract Terms Act. We get the idea that we regulate unfair contracts. We haven't had a new idea since the 1970s on this principle. So, we're still effectively doing the same thing. What we've done is like ramp it up, if you like. So, we've now got the idea of unfair contract terms across the spectrum. So, the FCA, the Financial Conduct Authority, is actually really useful, even in things like phone contracts, because they go around and regulate unfair contract terms. And then the most useful thing they do is they publish on their website that we think this is unfair. And then you can use that as like a library of, oh, this is unfair. So if it's unfair in a mortgage contract, well, it's probably unfair in a phone contract. And all of these ideas, might be unfair, and you might regulate them on that basis. I doubt Domino's have got an unfair term. They have got one weakness I will point out, which is that I don't agree with their interpretation of GDPR. So anybody watching this who's ever ordered Domino's knows that they ask you to opt out of emails and telephones. No, I think GDPR should be opt in, and
Well, I think
I
it
did.
is, isn't it? I think everybody's
But
very
it
clear
should
about
be.
that.
I don't know why nobody has challenged
Well, what
Domino's
we
yet
just
on
have,
this.
data is the new currency. Other pizzas are available, and even though they might do ham and pineapple together, I'm sure that maybe that's the biggest crime of all. But we could have a look at that. But no, it is important, and I think it's sort of understanding that. No, data is key. Data is the new currency, and my understanding is the same as yours, is that it's now opting. You have to opt in.
Yes, but I think GDPR has been in a terrible state since COVID. I keep getting emails from companies I haven't contacted for years, just sending me, and it's just like, you have obviously just decided to ignore GDPR. You have obviously decided that the ICO is a useless regulator. And these regulators are largely useless. I mean, the whole regulatory framework doesn't really work, and it doesn't matter which one it is. Ofwat's the reason all the water's rubbish. The Ofcom's the reason that GB News keeps getting attacked. This system isn't working, and it's going to need to look at. But look, I'm waffling off the subject. International law is treaties,
Yes.
and treaties are contracts. That's the first thing to really get in your head. And that means you can put whatever you bloody well want in your treaty. So if England and France, or Britain and France, want to agree that every year France will give us a goose and we'll give them a partridge, then that's what we'll damn well agree. And that's what we'll write in our treaty, the treaty. And we'll sign it in Coventry, just for the hell of it. And we'll call it the Treaty of Coventry. And that will be the Treaty of Coventry. And those will be our terms. The second most important thing to remember about international law, and this is really fundamental, is democracy came after international law. So international law and these treaties are the contracts of kings. They're not really designed to fit in a democracy. And every democracy has had to therefore adapt to this thing because they could be fundamentally anti-democratic. The principles of our democracy are parliamentary sovereignty, and no parliament can bind a future parliament. Treaties are therefore a problem because a treaty was signed by the previous whatever, and now it's claiming to still be law. And Parliament is like, no. And that is there is a fundamental conflict between international law and democracy. Unfortunately, the communists realized this a few decades ago, and that's why they're running around using international law and abusing it in a terrible way. But the answer is not to just get rid of international law. The answer is to understand it. Once you've got this idea, fundamentally, it's contracts. It's contracts between kings. it's not really fitting with a democracy. So what you then have to do is every democracy has to deal with it. And we are an outlier. So there's 194 countries. So there's, that's 194 constitutions. There's probably more, but let's just work on that basis that each one country, one constitution. Probably wrong, probably someone's got to. But every constitution, therefore, has to deal with this. And we deal with it one way that I'll get into later. But there is a standard model for dealing with it. And viewers and listeners should know that the reason that there's a standard model is because there have been events in history that have caused us to suddenly write a load of constitutions all in one big go. So the Second World War was a massive event in history. All the losers needed a brand new constitution. Boom. It's like, oh, right, we've got to get them a brand new constitution. Unfortunately, after the Second World War, the Americans stuck their oar in, which is why you get things like the European Convention on Human Rights, and you get these Second World War, post-Second World War constitutions. I mean, you can call me biased, Andrew, but I would have just imposed. I would have offered them all English law and just said, well, just use English law. Just use our model. Okay, it works. All of continental Europe, most of continental Europe fell to a dictator. You can sort of argue it wasn't really France's fault because it was just bad military and they got blitzkrieged. But they did fall. But they all fell. Loads of the others fell to a dictator. Like Spain fell to a dictator, Italy fell to a dictator, Germany fell to a dictator. They all fall to dictators. That means your constitution is rubbish. The whole point of a constitution in a democracy is to prevent a dictator. That's the number one goal of your democracy is to stop a dictator. So I would have just looked at us and go, well, we didn't fall to a dictator. So ergo, ours is the one to use. But anyway, the Americans didn't want that. There's a funny thing about Americans, Andrew, that people I think we all need to talk about much more openly, is they genuinely think the British Empire is going to come back at some point. They live in genuine terror of the, it's just like, and they look at us sort of, they know that we're their friends, but they sort of look at us a bit shifty, like, is he the one? Is he the one who's going to bring back the British Empire? And it's just like, but I don't think they realize we don't want an empire. But anyway, it's just, I
Well,
don't
there are
think
some who do, and there are some who behave as though.
it's. Oh, no! I mean, Nigel maybe, but who else? I've never met anybody who seriously wanted an empire. And I don't think England was ever that keen on an empire. And it's really Scotland that's the driving power for an empire. And to their credit, it's Scotland and Northern Ireland who provide something like 50% of the military power of the empire. So, I mean, and given that they're lower populations, that's pretty impressive. But I think the English were just sort of went along with it all. There was a great. The other thing that we don't talk about empire enough, Andrew, is the role of people who read The Guardian. So the people who now read The Guardian were very keen on the empire because back in the day, the people who read The Guardian were all fervently Christian and they all believed in saving the heathen savage and they needed to go forth and look after them. They wanted to care for them in exactly the same way Guardian readers still want to go and look after foreigners and foreign countries. And they thought that the best way to do that would be to govern them.
Yes.
So it's just, we just segued into empire. But empires, I mean, empires are part of international law too because. How you run one. And I think one of the most legally interesting points we can make about our one, when we had one, is that we really, really, really differed from the Roman Empire. So Rome would conquer a territory. For a start, we tended not to conquer territories. We tended to sort of go in and say, hello, do you mind if we run you? We think we're super. And it was, slightly more genteel. But anyway, Rome would conquer a territory and then Rome would impose Roman law. And that is absolutely, the standard. And throughout the entire Roman world, the entire empire, there was one law called Roman law. And we never, ever did that, ever. So Britain is made up of three different legal systems right from the get-go, because when Scotland and England merged, they didn't impose English law on Scotland and they didn't impose Scots law on England. They just went, we'll have our own system. And when we got Northern Ireland, we just went, you keep your law. And therefore, when we run India, we go, oh, well, you'll have Indian law. Yes, I'd be marvelous. And we did this throughout all the territories. So all the territories have their own basic legal system. They're often impacted by English law, but you get real oddities. So in the 1920s, I think it was, don't quote me on the date, but I'm pretty sure it was the 1920s, we passed through the Indian Parliament that we did control a contract act, the Indian Contract Act, that meant from 1920 till about 1990, India had better contract law than England had, because it was a really good act. It's really amazing. It's and the real deficit we had was corrected by the Contracts Rights of Third Parties Act, or initially corrected by Lord Denning in the 60s by I think overstepping his legal powers. But nonetheless, Lord Denning noticed that there's a major deficit in English contract law, and he shored it up. And then eventually the politicians noticed 30 years later, and they repair English contract law. But until then, Indian contract law was superior. And that is a sort of product of capitalism. It's a product of competition. It's a product of believing that competition will improve things. It's a product of, so I'm very against the communists. That should be obvious by now. Because the communists believe one size fits all and everything will be great if we just all exactly the same. They're sort of very Roman in a way. Whereas because I'm from the English legal tradition and because I'm British, I'm very much of, if you want to be different from me, you knock yourself out, kid. You know, I like spaghetti bolognese. If you like spaghetti carbonara, you knock yourself out. You know, and it just, why would you? I don't want other people to have to be like me. And I don't want to be like other people. I want everybody to sort of live and let live. And I think that is our legal tradition. That's what we did. I mean, we stopped things. So you get it in Phineas Fogg that we did impose on the Indians. On India. We stopped them murdering the bride when the husband died. And that is in Phineas Fogg and Around the World in 80 Days, and it's, you know, and he rescues her from being burned alive with her dead husband, and we did stop that. So we were imperial in a
Well,
way.
that's good, isn't it? I mean,
Well, we
that's
tended
the
to do
only
things.
thing we've done. That's got to be celebrated.
Well, but the empires don't generally do things in order to be deliberately malicious. You know, it's because you can't really. And if you're, you, how would you sell it to the people back home that you're doing something deliberately malicious? So when we interfered, we tend to be stopping things like that. And a lot of, you know, the colonies and dealing with Africa was because of genuine fears of cannibalism and things like that. And we did stop slavery. Again, a uniquely English obsession in the beginning. It was English law that banned slavery here, with the famous case where Lord Mansfield said the air of England is too pure for a slave to breathe. And then once we had imperial power, we felt able to impose a ban on slavery globally. The Americans have used their imperial power, which they are now an empire, and they're using their imperial power to carry on that ban, which is why we remain good friends, because none of us like slavery. Slavery is a moral human evil. I'm sad to say there's an awful lot of it going on, but it is a moral human evil. So that's why we fought it. Back to international law. Contract law. It's contracts. It's the contracts of kings. It's a problem for democracy. The standard, I was talking about the standard model of constitution. So you get a big batch after the Second World War, you get a big batch after the collapse of the USSR, and you get a big batch when South America is basically colonized, stroke liberated. And so you get batches of contracts, constitutions that come out. The standard model constitution, therefore, tends to, and the EU uses this model too, is to say it generally has some grandiose commitment to international law. So in the German constitution, it's in Article 25, and they go, "Oh, we really love international law. It's ace." Which it's not, I may be paraphrasing, but they make a sort of grandiose statement about international law. But what they will all do in the detail, because the devil's in the detail, Andrew, as you well know, is that they will all use a court to break a treaty that they don't like. So you could end up with a treaty that you don't like, because these are contracts of kings, and kings are sort of unregulated, and kings are not democrats. And you know, the power to sign a treaty in our constitution is with the prime minister. But it's really interesting, Andrew, that it's a royal prerogative. It's an old kingly power that we took all the powers off the king. Literally, have that. We'll have that one. Yeah, that one. Yeah, we'll have that one too. And all these powers are called prerogatives. And we took them and we gave them to various ministers. So we didn't even give them all to one minister, because we didn't really want a super minister. We wanted, you know, the ministers to be sort of. We thought it would. The British approach to power is to take it and to put it in lots of different places. That's what we like to do. We don't like it in one ring. That's what Tolkien was on about. That's what we're all worried about. We don't like putting it in one place. We don't want a king again. We have a king in order to not have a king. We are incredibly shifty. That is what we are. We are interesting people. But again, so that's the standard model. We'll use a court to break a treaty. So the EU just signed a treaty with Morocco, then decided, oh no, this is a really bad idea. It's going to flood our markets with cheap goods. Oh, what do we do? Court, will you break the treaty, please? And the court, it went to the court, and the court said, oh, the treaty involves Western Sahara, and that's a contested area. Therefore, it's morally wrong and against our principles. Bye-bye, treaty. I mean, total guff. I mean, genuinely least plausible thing in the world ever. And it's one of the reasons I don't like the standard constitutional model, because I think it brings your courts into disrepute. I think, basically the commission wanted the treaty broken, and basically the court was always going to break the treaty if the commission asked it to, and then it's just going to find a reason. And I like my courts to be highly respectable, and not just for moral reasons, it's good business sense
Oh, no,
globally.
absolutely. You have to have respect for the courts, otherwise the whole thing breaks down. So we've worked out, okay, so international law in summary is a contract between kings. In a nutshell, the distinction between domestic law and international law, and what are the implications of that distinction?
Well, so we got rid of our king. We cut his head off. And people don't talk enough about the Glorious Revolution, which happened afterwards with James II, which is probably more important than cutting off Charles I's head. But after we got rid of James II, it was the end of any argument about who's in control of the country. And it was the very, very clear it's Parliament. And they pass an act called the Bill of Rights, still in force today. People bang on about Magna Carta, most of which is not in force. And people should really be taught the Bill of Rights in school, and they're not. I think it's a disgrace. But the Bill of Rights was the really important one. And they stuck up two fingers to the courts, because the courts are royal power. So they go, you courts, or you can't touch us. We're above you. Go away. I mean, that I'm paraphrasing, but that is basically what they do. It's the world. It's our first what we call ouster clause, and they say Parliament is above the courts, and Parliament can't be touched by courts. And it establishes the supremacy of Parliament. Getting rid of the king and then replacing the royal line as well is another thing Parliament really does. So that's with George the First. That's a real, I'm in charge. It's, and we do it again with Edward the Eighth, and it's, Parliament is in charge. You abdicate, or we're getting rid of you, and we will get rid of you, and we have legal power to do so. We have the authority to get rid of you. You don't have necessarily the authority to get rid of us, although the king can dissolve Parliament. But anyway, don't worry. We have this balance, but Parliament is absolute king. So Parliament comes along and then says, "I don't like this. What's this? This treaty? Who's signing all these treaties? What's all this?" And so we have to develop a system for how we deal with it. And we don't use our courts at all because, again, because of that history, because our courts are connected directly to royalty and royal power, we don't, our constitution's a bit iffy about them. It's like, no. And this is what's kept them pure. And I like this. This is the outcome of this, is that our courts are pure and have a great reputation across the globe, because we just don't involve them in anything political. And the genesis of that is because Parliament didn't trust the courts because they were royal power. And it's not, so it's odd, isn't it? You get a really good outcome, but it's almost for a bad reason. It's like Parliament thought the courts were dodgy, didn't trust them at all, so it hasn't involved them in anything political. As a result, our courts have ended up being the most trustworthy on the planet. Weird, but true. So what we do is Parliament has the ultimate power over any treaty. We don't break it, which is our source of, so we won't break a treaty. We'll never say that we break a treaty. What we do is, if a treaty is to apply, then we will pass an act of Parliament and bring it into our law, an act called incorporation. But that's basically just bringing it into our system. And Parliament has to do that itself. And then for it to stop, Parliament has to pass another act repealing that act. and sending it out. That's called unincorporation. And this was at the heart of the Miller One case. I actually advised the government that they would lose Miller One, and Miller One was perfectly fine. I had no, absolutely no problem. I really don't understand why Theresa May fought it. It was bloody obvious because listeners and viewers will remember that Theresa May, for some reason best known to herself, said, "We'll leave the EU. I'll do it via EU law," which we might come back to or might do another episode on. But I think that was a mistake. But anyway, and I can do it all as Prime Minister. I don't need to use Parliament. It's just like, what? Are you drunk? Have you recently suffered serious head trauma? Obviously, that's not true because we had incorporated EU membership in 1974 by an Act of Parliament. And actually, Lord Denning did a case in the 70s where he set all this out. He said, "Well, Parliament has incorporated it all, and therefore, it's part of our law. If we ever want to leave, Parliament will have to pass an Act saying we have to. It has to go." But Parliament is involved, not the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister is not God. The Prime Minister is not a king. The Prime Minister is, is the first among equals. And what's really interesting constitutionally, and we don't talk enough about the loss of the Lord Chancellor,
Yes.
because when we had the Lord Chancellor was really close to being equal to the Prime Minister in power, like seriously close. Like, we've had to basically invent this idea of a deputy Prime Minister in order to sort of understand how the system all works. But the Lord Chancellor used to be somebody usually, 10, 20, 30 years older than the Prime Minister. Usually a very senior lawyer and a judge, or of great gravity, somebody of great gravitas and dignity, and who's deeply respected. So if the Lord Chancellor went to the King or Queen and said, "I'm afraid the Prime Minister's lost his marbles," then that would be enough for the King or Queen to go, "You know what? The Prime Minister has lost his marbles." It was a really serious constitutional mechanism. The Lord Chancellor didn't get to enact policies. He didn't get to get his own way, but he or she did get to be very powerful. They were seriously powerful individual. There was no way. And a lot of us think that we got rid of it largely because Tony Blair didn't like that. And so Tony Blair, his initial one was a man called Derry Irvine, who had been Tony Blair's pupil master. And
Yes.
that is, as you know, that is a very intense relationship. And I mean, I still remember my pupil master. We went to Croydon Combined Court, and my pupil master saw on the list that his old pupil master was sitting as a judge, and he instantly turned into a little boy. Instantly, like all the year, decades fell away, and he went, "Oh, I've got to go. You stay here, and Stephen, just stay here, and I'll go see him." And so he immediately went into court to see his old pupil master. And
Yeah.
it's like my dad is an academic, and I see that both with my dad's, they're called doctoral, so his doctoral students would be with him for years and years and years. And I call them all his second children. I mean, they're just basically like old
It
friends.
is an extraordinary, and it's one of those old things about apprenticeships. I think
Yes.
that's effectively what it is. The whole pupilage is an apprenticeship, and you always have that bond. And in addition to being a pupil, you have an opportunity. I am a member of Inner Temple, and Lord Justice Macpherson, William Macpherson, and I had the joy of being his marshal for a number of weeks, and he did the Macpherson report, you might remember, and all that sort of stuff, and it was a glorious insight to what that was, and a very special bond. I mean, you learn so much more by seeing and looking at how they basically conduct cases and so on and so forth. But you're right, that relationship just goes on forever, and you'd never really change the dynamics of it.
No, and so I don't think Tony Blair liked having his old pupil master as Lord Chancellor, because his old pupil master used to stand, I suspect, stand up to him and tell him no, and tell him
Yes.
all sorts of other things. So it became much easier for him to get rid of the role of Lord Chancellor, which he did initially, and then he realised that you can't. The constitution doesn't work, and we needed it back. So it was one of the great sort of mess ups of the Blair era that he had to bring back the Lord Chancellor. But he's brought it back in a very weak way. And as a result, I think we've already had more Lords Chancellor than we had in the entire history before that. So it's just ridiculous now. I can't, the current Lord Chancellor is Shabana Mahmood. And if you're telling me that I think Shabana Mahmood will stand up to Keir Starmer and tell him nay, then I think you're off on one. You're with Theresa May thinking she's going to win Miller One. You need to sit down, love. You've gone mental. But back to this concept. So that's how we regulate international law. We will bring it in, and then we will set it free. And once it's set free, we've ordered our judges to ignore it. So you ignore it. And that means that it can't really get us. So it's a concept. The Americans are quite similar to this. So the Americans think that they shouldn't pay the congestion charge in London because they think it's a tax, largely because it is. The Americans are right, I think. But anyway, successive mayors of London ignore that and say it's not a tax, it's a congestion charge. You have to pay it. So we keep charging the Americans congestion charge, and the Americans keep not paying it. It's now quite a large amount of money that allegedly the Americans owe us in law. So all those people who sort of, get very pious on Twitter and go, in law, we have an obligation. Yeah, so there are obligations that we all ignore from time to time. The Americans ignoring that one is a pretty good one. And we tend to ignore international law once it's unincorporated. It's becoming a problem because the communists don't like that. So they increasingly tried over the decades, they've tried to create permanent structures in international law. And I want viewers and listeners to think about this like Minecraft or, Lego. They've gone into international law, which is rules, and they've tried to build things out of it. The EU is something built out of international law. It's now got so grandiose that it says we're built out of EU law. But if you look at it structurally, EU law can only be international law. That's all it can be. So they are still made out of the same Lego as every other international legal structure. But there are competing ones. And they don't like each other, Andrew. So the EU and the ECHR don't get on. They don't like each other because they're threats to each other, because who's going to be in charge? It's a rivalry. The EU is supposed to join the ECHR. And when we signed this treaty, the Lisbon Treaty, which took apart the old, took all the Lego down and then rebuilt all the Lego up again into the EU, it's in there saying that the EU will join the ECHR. And what the EU did was it used that constitutional trick. It went skipping off to its court and it said, please say that we don't have to join. And the European Court of Justice has pa passed a case saying, no, the European Court of Human Rights is not compatible with the EU law because of.
And I think and that's what we're going to unpack in the next episode. We're going to look at applicability, we're going to look at enforcement and compliance. But for now, Stephen Barrett, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.